We got to do another episode. Welcome, folks, to, let's call it Chapter 2 of The Suspendables, with me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and of course, Russ Courtnell, who played so many years in the NHL and has so many stories that we're putting it in a podcast. I'm not letting them write a book. I don't like when they write a book. Anyway, on today's show, Russ has got lots to talk about, including retirement, what it's like to play under the microscope in Toronto, why players make bad coaches. Let's talk about that. And what to do about players who are just complete assholes on your own team. Are coaches making too much money? But most importantly, I've got some marriage advice for you guys. All that and much more coming up on today's episode. Russ Courtnell. Rusty, are you there?
I am here. I was just checking my mic.
Yeah.
Checking my recording device. Technology shit is just unbelievable.
I wish, Russ, what we should do is tape us trying to bring up each podcast with the producer that we have. He's in Australia. You're in L.A. I'm in Edmonton. We got two fucking mics going. We got him on the line with a merge call. Do the file. Just go to desk. This guy does not understand what he's doing to me. Okay? Just do this. Click here. Click there. If this thing comes off. If we could pull this off, Ross, we can write a fucking book, man. Anyway. I just got a feeling.
Should have a reality show filming this shit.
I got a feeling, Russ, we're gonna do
how this. You doing today, Jimmy boy? How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah. Have you smoked a few packs yet today?
I'm a pack a day guy, Russ. I'm a loyal guy. Okay.
Just a pack.
Yeah. You know what? Okay. I told you should take up smoking. You know what? Listen to you bugging me. Okay. Tell everyone, Russ. Tell everyone how whipped you are that you had to go to the nursery with your wife today to pick out flowers. What is wrong with you?
Oh my God, not flower. Hey, vegetables. Paris was, every year she plants her vegetable garden, and I did go to the nursery today. Just loved every fucking moment of it. And you know what? I'm now doing the podcast, so I can't plant it with her, which is the best part of it.
Yeah.
I spend an hour with you, for fuck's sake.
I understand what you're doing, Russ, okay? You're like, listen, honey, if this means I'm going to get a little action, I'll do anything you want, okay? Anything you want. That's how I look at it. Whatever you need, babe, I'll do all that.
Well, we won't get any marriage advice from you, big fella. Cock.
Like I said to my wife, Russ, when I don't know why it didn't work out, we were picking out rings. Right? We went to get the rings when we got engaged, and the jeweler was like, well, here's your choice.
Yeah.
And I said to her, well, you pick it. She said, no, you go ahead. I said, no, you pick it, honey. You got to wear it for the next 3 years. and listen, Rusty, here's the other thing, okay? This is a little advice for people out there before we get into the show. Okay, you know, people try and set you up with a girl or like you do this dating sites or friends are sending you on blind dates. Yeah. And you know what? Maybe there will be a time, Russ. Maybe you're going to see this girl and you're going to go, fuck, I think this is the one. I think this is it. Before you launch in, okay, to this commitment, Russ, every guy out there, just stop and ask yourself, is this the girl I want spending every second weekend with my kids?
And half your dough.
Yeah, and half your dough.
Oh,
that's
God.
Right. Yeah,
I can't. I can't understand why you're still single and divorced.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. We're gonna do an advice call.
Oh my God.
Anyway, let's. So when we do this podcast, we're into the first round of the playoffs. It's fantastic. I love playoff hockey. It's been exceptional. Everyone plays for their life. A couple things, Rusty, and we need your thoughts on all of this. One is, you had mentioned, I think, the last show, Tampa Bay got ousted 4 straight by Columbus, who was a huge, huge underdog in this thing. And it was a massive upset. And I was talking to you, I think, off air, and you said, I don't believe in upsets in the playoffs. What does that mean?
Did I really say that? Well, I will tell you what I think about what happened with Columbus.
Uh-huh.
And Tampa's been floating for a month or longer, and Columbus has been, up until the last game, they were fighting for a playoff spot, and they came in playoff mode because they've been in playoff mode for the last month, where Tampa has been, you know, just waiting.
Right.
And I remember we were Dallas Stars. We swept St. Louis in the first round, and we waited 8 days for Vancouver, licking our chops as they went 7 games against Calgary. Game 5, 6, and 7, they went into overtime, and they won each game. And they came into Dallas and absolutely kicked our ass. I mean, it was – and during the season, I'd have to look back on it. I think we beat them. We beat them every time we played against them. And so – They were in playoff mode. They were all cut up, bruised, and just hung, you know, ready to eat raw meat. And they came in and just blew us out in 5 games. Anyways, I think that's what I think happens. Tampa just was soft and relaxed, and Columbus came in and just kicked their ass.
What about this coach for Columbus, Russ, talking about winning a playoff? You know, Columbus won 4 straight. Tortorella has been a notorious coach in the league for years now, and he's an absolute fucking maniac, okay? You know him. He gave this ripping speech that they showed in the dressing room before. I think they were down 3-0 when they won that first game and came back and won 4-3. But he went off on the team. What's your take on this guy, Tortorella? I was saying, Russ, that I think he had a lot to do with the win because of this. What do you think?
Well, I think a coach like Torts, he's like the 3-4 year guy on a team, and then they start, you know, they stop listening to him, but they're listening to him, and he's a motivator, and he demands a lot from his team, and he's, as we all know, he's not afraid to call out anybody and everybody. And I like, that's the one thing I do like about him. It doesn't matter what number you have on the back of your jersey, you're fair game. And, you know, I played for some tough coaches, Pat Burns and Pat Quinn and Bob Gainey. But, you know, some of those coaches didn't rip into their star players. And you know, Bob was like Torts, Bob Gainey. And he, you know, everybody was would get a lashing, a tongue lashing. But I think, you know, he's a motivator, and then eventually guys get maybe tired of that, or they don't want to play the way he wants them to play, but he's had success. I guess Vancouver is probably the only place he didn't have success, but he's had success. So you got to give it to him, give him credit. And we all need to be motivated once in a while and be pushed. And he seems to be that guy.
So that being said, Russ, you know, you'll see every once in a while in sports, a couple thoughts here that players will be called out. Certainly we expect it from the coach. That's his role. That's what he gets to do. But have you ever done it as a player, Russ? Have you ever called out another player in front of the other guys or in the media? You know, you see you see it once in a while. Have you ever done it?
Players will argue and get at each other. And if you're close enough with your teammate and they trust you enough, sometimes that can happen. If a player obviously feels like you don't like them, I mean, that's different. But Neil Broughton, I freaking love Neil Broughton. Neil Broughton, by the way, should be in the Hockey Hall of Fame. And one of the best line mates I ever played with. He and Guy Carboneau.
Tough guy.
The best centerman I ever played with.
Really tough,
but,
right?
But Neil on the bench, I remember this in Minneapolis. I freaking love Neil. And he yelled at me for something. I didn't get the puck in or did something. And I was like, what? You're yelling at me? Right. I love you. But we had the respect and we cared for each other and we cared about how we played every night. And he didn't like what I was doing. And he told me, and it sure hit home for me because I'm talking about it probably 30 years after it happened, and I'll never forget it. So it just depends on players. Some guys, you know, call out everybody, and you can freaking go, oh my God, would that guy shut the fuck up?
Right.
Has he looked in the mirror lately? Those guys, you know, guys just don't ignore, but players like Neil or highly respected players on your team, guys will listen to because they usually do it at the right time. And like Mark Messier, I remember in New York, he gave it to everybody. You remember, you know how now everybody juggles the soccer ball before the games?
Yep.
that just started in the late 90s or mid to late 90s. And I get to New York and we lost a game and he blamed it on the guys juggling the soccer ball before the game.
Come on.
Yeah. So they weren't juggling the soccer ball after that for the next few games. It was priceless. Now every player's doing it before the game.
I saw the other day during a baseball game that a player came off the field. I don't know if he struck out or something. And next thing you see, the two of them are physically choking each other. They're on the same team. These guys in the dugout. Anything like that ever happened in the dressing room where guys got into it?
Back in Toronto, four guys thought it'd be a good idea to gang up on Wendell Clark and try and shave him. And he had them all four tied up in a knot. maybe in practice, a couple guys might have went after each other, fighting in practice because one guy high stick, one guy by accident or something like that. But I nothing really rings a bell right now.
Okay, I'll tell you, that brings me to another story. Antonio Brown, player in the NFL, I think it was with
Pittsburgh. I'm glad you're sticking to the fucking script you sent me today, by the way. Fuck that.
I am.
You haven't talked about one thing you shared with me 3 hours ago that we were going to talk about. That's why I can't fucking remember.
Russ, listen, anymore.
Jeez.
You're a beauty. This is an Oprah, okay?
What do you have, Alzheimer's?
You know what? You're lucky you're not in the room with me right now, okay? Oh, we're on the same team. Okay, I fucking come at you, okay? I'm small, but I'm crazy.
Yeah. Like you said last week, you're the last fight you were in, you won by 5 blocks.
Yeah, no, that's true. Anyway, my this guy's a distraction on a team, okay, on a professional team. He's just a freak. He's holding out of practice. He flew in on a chopper, to the game or to one of the practices. And he's an absolute pain in the ass to this team. But yes, but he's really good. He's really good. So
my are we question talking for baseball? You is, are we still on baseball?
We're talking sports. Okay. We're talking sports. That if there's a guy on your team, Russ, who's really fucking good, but he's an asshole, what do you do about that? What do you do? I was saying, fuck, the guy can do anything he wants if we're winning. What's your take on that? If you got one of these guys who isn't.
I mean, hockey's, I can only relate to hockey. And we have an asshole. Usually there's one asshole on every team, but he's usually not the best player. The best players have, the confidence, the respect. The asshole usually is some insecure guy that's worried about his job, so he's being a prick and a bully, and guys usually ignore somebody like that, or hopefully ignore him, or they get traded. But usually in hockey, the best players are pretty much class acts and guys you want to be around, and they're either a leader on and off the ice sometimes by just their play. Like Wendell Clark didn't say a lot. And but he led by example. And Gretz was like that too. Gretz didn't say a lot in the dressing room when I played with him, and he just led by example. But the pricks were usually the bottom five. I mean, all the time I played on six teams, and the pricks were usually. Maybe in Toronto we might have had a good player who was a prick, but I don't want to mention his name.
You were hurt. You hurt my feelings when you said the guys who are usually the idiots are the guys who are assholes and they're insecure. And I said, fuck, he's talking about me.
Thank God you're an Edmonton, eh?
Yeah, exactly. On another story, and this will get to our notes, Russ, I promise you. We'll get to our notes. Steve Yzerman, who was a prolific hockey player in the league, he went on to be in the front office in Tampa, and now he's taken another gig in Detroit, which is where he played all his whole career. And he's been a phenomenal guy on the Olympic teams and Team Canada teams. And I was saying, Russ, I don't understand why the guy is doing it. I don't understand why he's, with all he's accomplished, why he's taken on another gig. He's probably my age or your age and mine. I'm late 50s.
Yeah, we're the same age, same draft year. I think Stevie, he says by all accounts, he loves it. He loves building. He loves being in charge. It's exciting. You know, I get to talk to Wayne a little bit, you know, here and there about his role now with Edmonton. And you can see that, you know, he's enjoying being involved at the level he's at, where Stevie is full on. And then the guys love Steve. I mean, everybody loves Stevie. I reached out and congratulated Lisa the other day and sent her a message via Instagram. But she responded right away how excited they are to be back in Detroit. I think Detroit really is home for them. Their kids were all born there and or at least raised there. And I think he's so proud of the Red Wings, what they did for him, what he did for them. And now he has a chance to come back and try to get back to those glory years. And you know what? The guys, I mean, Stevie's made a lot of money in his career, both playing and being a general manager. And I'm sure they're paying mm-hmm. him a ton of money. And you know what? It's I don't want to say it's easy, but he knows it. He did, you know, it's easy for him to go to work every day, I'm sure, and he's 53 years old. I mean, or 54. So yeah, you know, he's
yeah.
What is he going to do, golf every day in Florida? Oh, yeah, maybe you would want to do that.
Well, you know, this brings me to the point about guys when they finish their career, and I want to ask you this. I would just think they want to retire. You know, they played 20 or plus years in the league. They played at a very high level. And one of my thoughts, Russ, is the reason they do it is because they get fucked up from being retired. That, you know, you've heard this time and time again with people. Mm-hmm. Even in sports or in life, when they go to retire, they can't do it. They can't sit around the house. And, you know, for a hockey player, Russ, you live this, and I want your thought on this. You know, you're on the road. It's a different lifestyle. You're away from your family, but that's all some of these guys know. When you did you find it difficult to retire when you did hang it up? First of all, what made you decide to hang it up, Russ? How was retirement for you?
In 1999, I prepared, like I did every summer, to go to training camp. And I just, the deals that I was offered, that I had a couple that were financially weren't great. And in cities, I was like, oh, now I got to move my family. My oldest had just started kindergarten. I was mentally ready. I was burnt out the last few years of my career and, anyways, I retired in L.A. and had no problem retiring. I mean, I wanted to play, and then when it didn't happen, you move on. You hope to move on. I think that for some players, retiring is so difficult because their whole life is based on this celebrity professional athlete, and then it's gone, and that's mm-hmm. an unfortunate part of if somebody is consumed by being that celebrity person and you know, signing autographs and being recognized and all that stuff. And of course it's fun, but Boreas Salming taught me early on in my career to watch out for that kind of stuff. He says the guys, you know, the higher guys climb, the farther they fall. And he said, just be humble and enjoy this journey in your life, have fun. And then it'll be done one day. And so that Boria's advice to me really helped me through my career. And I played with some great Hall of Fame players that helped me too. I learned a lot from them. But I think players retiring the first year or two, they should go to a city where maybe it's not a big hockey market or a non-hockey market at all, and live there and try to find out who they are and where they're going to go. But when you're young, like we are when we retire, and still healthy, most of us, and probably still feel like we can play, but our bodies may be saying, no, you can't do it anymore. You go to Starbucks in the morning after you drop your kids off in Calgary, and where you've just finished your career, and everybody in the shop's going, you could still play, you could help us, you could this, you could that. And you can't retire, right, and you can't get away from the game. And I always tell younger players, If you can leave the city, just leave for a couple of years, take your family, go somewhere, and then come back. But man, it's hard for guys in these hockey markets, especially the big ones in Canada and the US, that when they hang them up and then have everybody remind them every day of what they just did for the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. It's not easy.
You know what? You bring up an interesting point because you played for Toronto. I know a couple of stories, Russ, maybe you do too, that guys who went there almost said, I got to get the fuck out of Toronto. I can't take it. And that's player. I know there's one guy, I want to say Brian Berard, but I forget there was a guy in Toronto who got traded to Florida and everyone's going, oh my God, what a bad deal. Why would you go to Florida to play in the NHL instead of sticking in Toronto? And the guy said, I fucking hated being under the microscope. It was awful.
I have a different feeling about that. I do not want a player on my team who doesn't want to play in Toronto or Montreal or New York or Boston. I don't want that player because I want a player on my team that enjoys the pressure of being in that spotlight, in that market. But the guy who can't handle it, I would trade him to the frickin' moon. I don't want these guys who want to play in fucking Florida and California to get, you know, get away from it. They can have them.
Right.
I want somebody who, yeah, when I played in Toronto, Montreal, you have a bad game. Everybody looks at you like you dropped your grandfather's 95th birthday cake, walking it across the room. I mean, it's not
right.
I'll tell you a quick story. Chris Chelios and I went out to eat and in Montreal after a game, we lost 4-2. I don't know who beat us. We didn't lose too many in at home, but we lost and we wanted to go out. I was waving down the cab Chris was saying goodnight to his wife, Tracy. And I waved down this cab outside the restaurant and we're going to go to a bar. And the cab driver said, And the cab driver said, rolls down the window and says, you fucking guys lost tonight. Get another car.
he stiffed you.
Then he took off.
He gave you the stiff.
Oh my God. So that's it. They're so passionate. And I loved it. I mean, you could be half asleep. I lived downtown Montreal and I'd walk to the Forum every night. For my game and you could just feel it, oh my God, all day long. And then the walk to the game, the buzz of the city and the kids waiting to get an autograph and your picture and, you know, go get them. Like they want you to win maybe more than you want to win. And it's fabulous. So I was
so did you miss
to
that?
Play in the, people always ask me, hey, Russ, how long are you going to play for? And I always said six more years. I kept saying that until the last few. And then I said, maybe a few more years. But I always knew there right. was an end to it. You know, I always knew that one day this is going to end. And I don't know how long I'm going to play. And I mean, I enjoyed all the celebrity that comes with being a professional athlete, but I didn't get up in the morning living for it. I mean, I didn't go out seeking it. And I think people who right. seek it have a real problem after. And, you know, look at actors too. You know, they're young, hot actor, you know, man or woman. You see them 40 years later trying to look like they did 40 years ago because that's when they were famous on some TV show or movie. And so right. if you get caught in that cycle, circle, whatever it is, and you live to be a celebrity or, you know, I it's really unhealthy. And I just never did that. I mean, I didn't.
Right.
I enjoyed it, but I didn't. When I retired, I didn't go, oh, my God, now I'm not, you know, not going to do this and not going to do that. I was like, I got a young family. I'm going to travel and play golf. I started looking forward, not backwards.
How come, Russ, you didn't, stay in hockey though on some other level? A lot of guys, you know, the superstar players, for example, I want you to address this too, because it's interesting that a lot of really good hockey players and superstar players who went into coaching, I think they went into coaching, not because they wanted to, because someone asked them to, and they were like, fuck, I've done everything in the game. mostly when those guys get in there, they don't make very good coaches. There's tons of history when you look back. And first of all, why do you think that is? Why well, like Wayne, I would never say anything bad about Wayne, but I think he had a hard time didn't like it. You know, and there's other players who've tried it and they don't make very good coaches. How come?
I think that I'll give you an example. My brother Jeff and I. Jeff is an excellent coach and should be coaching in the NHL. And because the reason he's an excellent coach, like a lot of players who, and Jeff was a really good player, but some of the players that say were a grinder or defensive defenseman or, you know, bubble players or played in the minors, they really had to study and learn the game, where I think the better players just played and it came naturally. And that you'd say, well, how'd you do that? Why'd you do that? And they're like, I don't know, I just did it. Where my brother, he studied every goalie in the NHL. He grinded his way through the minors, never drafted, fought, played whatever way he could, and just found a niche and then started scoring goals and became a great player. But he really studied the game. He would phone me before games and say, if you're on the half wall, and he phoned me in the 89 playoffs against Calgary. He goes, if you're on the half wall on the offside, on your offside wing, on the power play, step into the top of the circle, close your eyes and shoot at top shelf on Vernon. I'm telling you right now, it'll go in. You can go back and look at the tape. It was game two, I think. I freaking half wall stepped in and blasted it right over his shoulder, went in. But Jeff had a book on every goalie. He knew exactly where they were weak. He told me about Ray Bourque one day. He goes, Ray's got a bad knee. Go down the left side, fake outside, go inside. He can't turn to the inside. And I went down on Ray, faked outside, went inside. And shit, he went. He had to turn towards the boards. And I went in. I didn't score, but it was hilarious. But
that's player, funny.
Those guys who are really good coaches that weren't maybe great hockey players, they sat back and they had to learn and really study the game to stay at that level. And so back to why I didn't get into coaching, because I'm more of I would have been a decent assistant coach. I coach kids. I coach my son all through till Bantam. And I was better as an assistant coach than a head coach. And I loved the individual contact. So I wouldn't have made a good coach. And I would have preferred to be in management. And I don't know. I didn't want to stay in the game when I left. Unfortunately, now that I've got my kids are getting older, it'd be nice now to be, you know, involved in some way, but it's too far gone. I've been out of the game 20 years, but the guys who are in the game, usually right after they retire, they go in at scouting or assistant coaches or some level of management. And they've had that in mind pretty much the end of their career. It's similar to the guys in media, you know, the Ray Ferraros and the other guys of the world. Like when they got knocked out of the playoffs, they were, you know, telling the news, whoever's covering the playoff games, you know, I'd like to try it. And they've built a beautiful career. Ray, I listened to Ray last night on NBC and he's so good. And Craig Simpson's another guy who's just awesome. Like Simmer is so good.
Sure.
And so sure. I don't know, but I kind of got off track there, but so those guys, that's what they wanted to do. And they've done, most of them who are involved have done a great job.
Well, most, you know, back in your day when you retired in the late 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or early 90s?
90,
early
99. 90s,
late 90s.
99. Did you see my retirement? No. Hey, as I tell people, Gretz and I finished playing the same time. He retired and I was retired.
Yeah. Between you and Wayne Gretzky, you've got 70 records in the NHL between the two of you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, back in the day, though, I mean, the money was so fucking shitty to be a scout or an assistant coach and all that. But now it's good. You know, now I guess these assistant GMs and stuff, they're making $300,000-$400,000 a year.
Well, that was the other thing financially. It just, to me, wasn't worth it was a lot of freaking work. And those guys who have stuck with it for 20 years, I mean, every guy who's coached and gone in the media, I mean, they're all reaping the benefits now. I mean, look at coaches. God, I think when I left, the coaches in the 90s were probably making $500,000 or $600,000, maybe. And now they're making millions. And
you know, it's funny you bring that up because it's playoffs. And the fucking fans, okay, if their team doesn't get through the first round or didn't make the playoffs, their takes all the time are not just you got to get rid of the coach, but it's always it's always tagged or footnoted with, that fucking Babcock's making $5 million a year. That's way too much money for this fucking coach. What's your thoughts on that, about the dough that coaches are making now? Are they making too much? Or should they make more?
I think they're well deserved, because you know, a lot of these guys, they get in and they're out. You know, not too many coaches have these careers where they can retire or they get too old. Look at Hitch. Hitch started in the juniors, and then he went in the minors, and then he got the NHL, and he has made an unbelievable career of coaching. So there's not too many of those guys like Hitch. Guys come and go. Quenneville's a great example. When he was an assistant in Colorado, he's probably making $120,000 or $150,000. I don't know. And last however many years, he's been making millions of dollars. But he's worked a long, long time to get what he's getting now. So I think they all deserve it, because some guys have been busting their ass forever, not making a lot, and then other guys get in and then they didn't win and they're done. You know, they're just
right.
They made a few bucks, like the 3-year deal, and then shit, they didn't win. So they're assistant coaches. I mean, you look at the teams, and I'm just amazed at the assistant coaches. You'll see a couple young guys, but then you'll look over and there's like, oh, that guy used to be a head coach, and this guy used to be a head coach, and they haven't got a crack ever again. I mean, they just didn't win.
Tough grind, man. It's a tough grind, right?
Yeah, it is.
Tell me this.
It's a big, big market now. They're all making lots of money. I love it.
I'm going to ask you something else. Connor McDavid, who arguably is the best player in the league, misses the playoffs again with the Oilers. This year, he's making whatever he's making, $13, $14 million a year. I forget what his contract. It was a giant fucking contract. Russ, if you're Connor McDavid, I think he has a 7 or 8 year deal. If you're Connor McDavid and you miss the playoffs again next year, are you marching in there and asking for a trade? Or are you going, no, I bought in, I'm loyal, the owner stepped up and paid me a bunch of dough? What if you were Connor, what would you do next year if the Oilers missed the playoffs and you're the best guy in the league?
Oh, God, that would be so disappointing for him. But you know what? He just has to stay in his lane and play hard. And if they ask him, tell him what he thinks they need. But going in and, you know, making demands I think it's a mistake. I think that the team's probably smart enough to go, what are we missing? What do you think we need? Or here's what we're thinking of doing.
Yeah.
But marching in, making demands is not well advised. He's young. Mike Modano had to tough it out for some lean years in Minnesota and Dallas, and he just kept working. And Steve Yzerman, look how bad Detroit was for Steve, probably the first half of Steve's career or mm-hmm. first third. They were freaking awful. And the only team worse than them was ours, Toronto Maple Leafs. And but he stuck it out, and Stevie Y worked. And you know, there was a time when he thought he was going to get traded, Stevie. And I think it was when Bowman might've first got there. And there was a tough time for Stevie, cause he played with Shepherd and somebody else, and they thought they were all getting traded. And you know what? Stevie changed his game and a little bit, you know, played more two way, and they went on to win the cups. Mike Badano, same thing. Bob Gainey wanted him to be better in his own zone, and he did. But he kept up the play in the offensive zone, and he ended up winning a cup. So there's two examples from my era of guys who were, you know, top 10 players in the league, and they didn't march in and tell the GMs anything, I don't think. I know Mo wouldn't have. I don't know about Stevie, but I don't think Stevie's that person either.
Do players, when you brought this up earlier, do players make trades on teams? Do they, are they allowed to go in there? Does it happen? Am I too naive to think it's only the management that makes trades, or do players go in and go?
What do you mean? Like the player goes, hey, can we trade for this guy?
No, we got to get rid of this fuck. You got to get rid of this guy. You brought this up earlier.
Oh, I think I've heard some stories of, at the exit meeting at the end of the year, that the GM and coach asked about two players on a team, one or two. It was one or two. And every player but the guy's roommate said the guy was a bad act and terrible in the locker room. And they freaking traded him. So was the GM asking the players. But then, not that I know of.
Yeah.
Not that I know.
I think it happens. I'm not totally sure, but I think back in the day with the Oilers that, you know, that mess and if Paul Coffey and Mess and Wayne sat down with Slats, and if all of them came forward and said, look, you got to fucking dump this guy. He's brutal. I think probably it would happen, you know.
If you got enough players saying, you know, we don't like this guy and he's bad in the room, you got to have a really good locker room to have a really good team on the ice. And if you don't have a really good locker room, you're not going to be the best you can be on the ice. It's got to be fun. It's got to be respectful. And when you guys go out that door, you're going out as a unit. You got each other's back. And if you don't have that, man, you're just not going to, you might have success, but you won't have the kind of success that you deserve or should have. If you're a really, really good team or not. I mean, you need a good locker room for sure. And if you got bad eggs in there, you gotta get rid of them, I think.
Rusty, it's hard to believe, but we're almost out of time. This is great stuff. Great fucking stuff, my friend. Great stuff. And now the reason we've got to leave now is because you got to go put your apron on. Apparently, you got to do some laundry. Your wife has you doing that. Well, our next show, Russ, I want to talk to you. We don't have time now, but I want to talk to you about fighting. Everyone's fucking freaking out again about fighting, whether it should be allowed or not. Ovechkin got it in with the Russian kid, 19-year-old kid that was...
Fuck, that just elevated his respect around the world of what kind of player he is. I mean, it's kind of like Mark Messier, right? I mean, the fact that he can fight like that just, to me, made him even a better player. The guy asked for it, he gave it to him. And he I love Ovechkin. I always have. I've loved his enthusiasm, how he loves every game. He loves when he scores, his teammates scores, they win. And he pounded that guy, and it just made me respect him even more. So you know where I'm going to go next show with the fighting.
Okay. I'll tell you why. I like what a fucking right hook. Anyway, let's save that. We're going to talk. Oh, he fucking hammered him. Just boom. In the choir, you know. So anyway, we're going to talk about that next show. Rusty, this was great. Go back to doing your chores.
Okay.
We have a look.
Yeah. I'm back.
You hear that?
Back
you hear the wind? Yeah. We'll see you later.
Over and out.
Well, there we go. Two shows down. Can you imagine how much all of you learned today? Really? We're called the Suspendables. Jerome and Courtnell Unleashed. We should have an advice column, really, when I think about today's show. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you later.